Caught Offside with Andrew Gunling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes! Caught Offside from the Upper West Side of Manhattan, Andrew Gunling. And from all the way across the Atlantic Ocean in Ireland, JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
Hey, man, how are you? I'm ready to jump to some conclusions here.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that time. It's that time. After the for those new to the podcast, in both MLS and in the Premier League, following match day three, we do a little something called our Jump to Conclusions Week, where we feel like we've seen enough to make wide-sweeping conclusions, or not. That's the thing. We'll throw a statement out there, and then you and I both decide if we plan on jumping to that conclusion. Before we get to that, I do also want to say we have another podcast out this week where I go through some of the big moments from the weekend in the EPL, and then you join a little bit later on for a big mailbag. And also I take you to task for a thing that you did that was just pure evil. I don't really know how else to say it. You'll have to download that podcast to see what it was you did that caused me to truly want to beat you senseless for the second time ever since we knew each other. And then on this podcast, we'll do our jump to conclusions in just a moment. But I had the chance to speak with John Strong of Fox, who is obviously back now calling MLS games following his summer in Russia for the World Cup. Our first chance to speak with him since that experience. So it's a great, great conversation. So make sure you keep it locked in later on in this pod for that. Also, what to watch for. But JJ, before all that, we do this.
You see, it would be this mat that you would put on the floor and would have different conclusions written on it that you could jump to.
That's right. The mat is down. I have unrolled it. I'm looking at it right now. It's beautiful, a little dusty. Had to take it out of the Caught Offside closet. That is what we refer to the closet here as. And we're ready. I've got five conclusions here in front of me. I'll say what the we'll go through each one, and we'll decide if we are prepared to, in fact, jump to that conclusion. You ready?
Yes, sir.
Conclusion one, Jose Mourinho is done at Manchester United.
I'm not going to jump to that conclusion, Andrew.
Neither am I. I'm with you.
And I'm not jumping based on listening to Gary Neville. First of all, Gary Neville is such a national treasure in terms of his thought and his analysis. But his thought and analysis on that is quite interesting because he takes it from an Ed Woodward perspective. And I tend to agree with it. And I subscribe to his view that Ed Woodward is not in a position where he wants to get rid of the incumbent manager at this point in time. Now, don't forget that Ed Woodward is very much aware of the way Mourinho runs things. He's had, you know, so much of his experience of the Mourinho way. And yet the contract extension was still tabled in January 2018. And I think that Ed Woodward is looking at the tradition of Manchester United. And I think he's looking at the way the club maybe made mistakes in the past few years, certainly with David Moyes. They did something that was very unlike United. They brought a manager in and gave him no time. Mm-hmm. Louis van Gaal at 2 years, fair enough. I think, though, with van Gaal, there was a general, maybe there was a view that United needed to change tact and win now. Now, they brought Mourinho in to win now, and yeah, he won two trophies, the Europa League, and he won the League Cup. But I honestly think Ed Woodward, has to realise or figure out what United's next step is. And I don't think he is going to jump. I don't think he's going to get rid of Mourinho because it puts him in a position where he is forced immediately to figure out what this club was. And Neville makes the point, Andrew, that this club, for the most part, was a club that was built on giving the manager time. You look at the two most successful managers in the history of the football club, Matt Busby, came in on the 1st of October 1945 and finished in 1969. Now, I know in between Matt Busby and Alex Ferguson, there were managers that, you know, came in and came, you know, were finished pretty quickly, like Frank O'Farrell, But if you look at Tommy Docherty, look at Dave Sexton, even Ron Atkinson, they did get time. Like Ron Atkinson got 5 years. And I'm not saying Woodward's looking at those managerial examples and thinking we need to return to this model. But I genuinely think he's in a mind frame now where he sees no value in getting rid of Jose Mourinho right now.
Yeah, I agree with most of that. I don't believe that this is a move. However Jose Mourinho may feel about Ed Woodward and whatever their personal relationship has descended into, I don't believe that he wants to fire him. Part of that may be because I don't know who the natural successor is for Mourinho right now. If they want to just kind of scuttle through the remainder of the year with an interim manager and then deal with it at the end of the season, fine. But it feels way too early to have reached that conclusion. If there was a natural guy who was next in line, then maybe we'd be having a different conversation. But I just don't think that United are in that place right now. Now, we say, you believe he's done at Manchester United? I do. I should say this. I believe he's close. I think he's teetering. Now, they have, I think, 4 games coming up against non-top 6 opponents. If there is a setback there, then I think the conversation changes once again. I mean, this is kind of week to week that we're living in right now with Jose Mourinho and his job status. But I believe that he'll at least be given the chance to right the ship. If we're going with a declarative statement there, then no, I don't think he's done. Now, you do mention the how things have changed since Alex Ferguson. I saw this on Opta Joe on their Twitter. Yesterday was Manchester United's 50th home defeat in the Premier League. 32% of those, so 16 of those 50, have been in the seasons since 2013-14, so following Sir Alex Ferguson's departure. That's pretty amazing. I mean, in such a tight window, I guess it goes to show his greatness, and it goes to show a little bit of the chaos that has unfolded there since.
Well, I think the chaos is a relative term. Off the field, Manchester United is making money. It's doing very well. It is still a giant of a club. But in terms of on the field, they're still trying to negotiate the post Alex Ferguson era, and they're trying to really figure out what they are, Andrew. So when they brought Mourinho in, they were like, we want to win now. We don't want to leave too long of a gap between our last Premier League, and the win now hasn't happened. But I would say the long term successor to Jose Mourinho would be someone like Maurizio Pochettino. And at this moment in time, Pochettino is not going anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, so he signed a 6-year deal. And look, contracts are barely worth the paper that they're written on. But, I mean, that is something. That did feel like a significant commitment that he was making to Spurs, especially going into the new stadium. I don't know. If that's Manchester United's fallback plan, that's not going to be an easy one to follow through with.
And I believe that they will look at the options around and say that there isn't the plan going forward, and they're going to stick and let, or at least as much as possible, try and let Mourinho see out this contract and then take it from there. But it's an amazing crossroads for the club. What is United now? Where do they want to be? How do they get the manager in who's going to have the vision to take the team forward for the next? Because clearly, I think Ed Woodward wants a manager for the long term. I know we say long-termism is gone in football, but long-termism seems to work for United, and they don't seem comfortable in this flux. It's not like Chelsea, where Abramovich has basically chopped and changed managers for a decade and still maintained a winning formula. In the years since Sir Alex Ferguson has left, the 6 years or so, I guess, that hasn't been the case. And so United are trying to negotiate this period. It's very interesting. Short answer, I don't think Mourinho is done at United. I'm not going to jump on that.
Okay. Conclusion 2. Tell me if you're jumping to this one. Liverpool are even better than we thought they'd be.
I'm not going to jump on this one. I'm going to say they are as good as we've expected them to be. I don't think they're even better. I think what they are is, I would swap the word better with resilient. Now, we have a sample size of 3 games, but what I would say about the Brighton and Hove Albion win at home at Anfield, and what I would say about the Crystal Palace win, was those were 2 games that I don't think Liverpool even played at full throttle in either of those games, and they still won. And that's what's important to me. And I would say, I would add something onto this jump to conclusion, if I may. Liverpool are even better than they thought we would be. I think they're even more resilient than we thought they would be. And I also think that they're in a title race now, and that there is a title race between themselves, Manchester City, and possibly Spurs.
This is after
three games, right, Andrew.
Exactly. Exactly. Look, I'm not jumping to this one either, not by a long shot. No. And that's not a shot at Liverpool, but that's simply if we looked at their fixtures before the season began and saw West Ham, Crystal Palace, Brighton, Hove Albion, we'd say, well, okay, Liverpool should have 9 points after the first three matches. Now, I think we were all a little bit blown away by that opening performance against West Ham, but fast forward now to after these next couple matches and look at West Ham. They're horrible. I mean, defensively, they are a complete disaster. I'm not saying that you know, throws shade at what Liverpool were able to do against them. But no, I don't think I can look at that and say, wow, Liverpool have really blown me away. I think it's kind of appropriate. I think I agree with you. I think they're sort of where we thought they would be at this point.
I think so. And, you know, some people are really trying to ramp Liverpool up into something that they're not. Well, I won't say that they're not, but they're not at quite yet, and that we can't possibly make comment on because we haven't played enough games. Just take, for example, the save Alisson made at the weekend from the header. Mm. You know, in real time, that looks like a fantastic save. But when you slow it down and you see it, it's exactly the kind of save he should be making. It was a standard save for this goalkeeper. Yet Twitter is ablaze with people saying, oh, this is why we bought him, yada, yada, yada. I just think Liverpool are exactly where we thought they would be. And I think the thing for me that I really like is the fact that that game against Brighton, maybe under Brendan Rodgers or certainly in the early seasons of the Klopp era, is a game that probably finishes 1-1 and Liverpool are very frustrated. Liverpool got it done. And that would be the small amount of huge optimism I would take from like three games, which is nothing.
I guess the one thing that I would say to at least throw some praise at them, I think we've seen a lot of things. There were some question marks maybe coming into the season about them. Things that, okay, we all believe that they could contend for a title, but if this comes undone, it could bring the whole thing crashing down. So far, any of those question marks, like for the people who thought, well, can Mo Salah replicate what he did last season? Well, we still don't know that he will, but right now it doesn't look like there's been any drop off in what you're going to be getting from him this year. I mean, he's scoring every week. For the people who were questioning their defending, like I was, because of Dejan Lovren, well, I don't even know if he's going to get into the side. And Virgil van Dijk looks like he might be one of the best center halves, if not the best center half in England. Andy Robertson, if last year you thought, well, he was good, but is he really that good? Well, so far, yeah, he's phenomenal. Naby Keita, same thing. You know, we heard a lot about that signing. Now we've had a chance to see him. He's great. He's the real deal. So they have ticked every box so far that maybe we wondered about coming into the season. So it's all encouraging. It's all good right now for Liverpool, but no, I wouldn't necessarily say that they're better than we thought they would be.
I think that's fair.
Third conclusion. You ready?
Okay.
Watford are this year's Burnley.
Now, I wasn't going to jump to this one, but I read a really good article on Football 365 by Sarah Winterburn, and she talks about the stability at the club. And what do we talk about Burnley? What's the word we use most about Burnley, I suppose, over the last few years? Even when they were relegated, they stuck with Sean Dyche. There was a stability to this team. Here's an interesting line from that article, Andrew, and this is why I am going to jump with this. Mm. To those who think Watford always start well, so we should not be surprised that they have notched three straight victories in their first three games, it's worth noting that this has not happened since the days of Graham Taylor. Indeed, it has been almost 3 years since they won three consecutive Premier League games at any juncture of the season. That's pretty incredible stuff. I mean, three consecutive wins is huge for Watford. There's also the manager who we've looked at Watford and we said, if anything, they've not had that stability at manager. How could they possibly keep putting out a team that's going to stay in the Premier League if the manager literally has he's on death row straight away when he gets that job. And Javi Gracia has done an unbelievable job so far, and it looks as if maybe he's going to stay in that job a little longer. And I remember back to our Premier League preview pod where you talked about, and I'm not having a go at you, but you talked about, what did you say about Watford, Andrew?
I think I had them as a relegation candidate. I'm trying to remember if I had them going down.
But you said they screamed average. That's what you said.
Okay.
And honestly, you look at that team and you think, well, the Troy Deeneys, he's a, you know, he hasn't scored a goal in open play since last November. But if you look at the addition of Pereira, you look at even Will Hughes. Will Hughes looks like a new player. Etienne Capoue. I'm still saying these names and I'm thinking, nah, you know, this team, fairly average, kind of bog standard mid-table players. But they've been really, really good. And they've a system and they have made some good signings and they have a young manager who clearly is confident and knows what he's doing. Andrew, I'm going to jump to this one. I think that there's a Burnley-esque feel about them in a way.
I'm not going to jump. I'm not ready to abandon some of the concerns that I had about them coming into the season. I mean, just to put it in perspective for you for a moment, after match day three a year ago, so a year ago at this very time, you know who was in third in the table? Huddersfield. It's very hard to look at the table right now and make any kind of conclusion when you're talking about a team that you have grave concerns over. You know, Burnley last year finished ahead of Everton, ahead of Leicester. Like I look at this Watford team, and I just don't think they are. I don't think they're better than those teams. Now, Roberto Pereira is a player that maybe I didn't quite take into account because he's been awesome so far.
Yes.
But, you know, is this team going to be able to continue scoring goals at the rate that they have been? Are they going to be able to continue to defend like they have been? They have Spurs coming up this weekend, which will maybe be a little bit more telling into just how good they could potentially be. But I don't know. I'm not saying they'll be bad, and maybe viewing them as a relegation candidate will turn out to have been wrong. But I'm not ready to, I mean, Burnley qualified for Europe. I'm not ready to say that. Certainly not ready to say that for Watford.
Well, look, it's worth making the point that these jump to conclusions are wild leaps forward. So let's not hold ourselves too strongly to these opinions right now. You're right, after three games. But you've got to say that it feels more stable. It feels more like there's something good happening at Watford than it has for a while.
These things change really fast. It's like you said, it's three games. I don't know. Although, last year at this time, that was enough to have gotten Frank de Boer fired.
Poor old Frank.
Yeah. Next conclusion?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Spurs didn't need anyone in the transfer window after all.
Huh. I don't know.
I'll go first.
I've some thoughts.
I had a hard time with this. I struggled with it. And I will probably change my answer many times throughout the course of the season, as these seasons are roller coaster rides. But I am not going to jump to that conclusion. It is a long season. I mean, look at what Tottenham just did to Manchester United. One of the key figures in that game, despite the fact that he had a bad giveaway that almost led to a Manchester United goal. But by and large, I thought Moussa Dembele was once again great. And you know how much I love him. He can't play two games. He's kind of like on the Ledley King schedule. If you remember how Ledley King could only do so much towards the end of his career, but he was still a tremendous player. He couldn't train, couldn't play two games in a week. Moussa Dembele is kind of heading towards that. Tottenham's... their ambition now is not just this, to be good and relevant. I feel like we're past that with them. They got to win something, whether that's the league, the FA Cup, the Champions League, or go deep in the Champions League. It's going to get harder. Guys are going to get hurt. It's just the way that it is. I do believe that there is solid depth on this team, but I still just can't help but wonder if, you know, like, do I know how much I love Lucas Moura? Do I know that he's going to continue scoring goals at this rate? I don't know. I don't know. You know, I'm still a little bit uncomfortable that they didn't do anything. I will say it was encouraging near the end of that United game to see Harry Winks come in. You know, you get reminded, like, oh yeah, that's right, he was good. But if the goal is to win something, if the goal is to if we're just past the point where top four is okay, if the goal is to compete with Manchester City and I guess you'd have to say Liverpool right now as well, I don't know. I still just can't be okay with the fact that they didn't do a single thing. I hope they prove me wrong, but I'm just not there yet.
Can I apply a simplistic approach to this? Now, bearing in mind that Lucas Moura was bought in the January transfer window. Mm-hmm. So that is a signing this year that Spurs have made. And I think I won't say he's blaspheming, but certainly his performance in Old Trafford, he seems to be getting better. And you're a big fan of his. You felt as if he should have got more time starting even last season when he came into the club. Correct?
Yeah, the first time I saw him in that FA Cup match, I forget who it was against, but it was like a League One side or a League Two side, and he was sensational. And I remember you telling me, well, it's hard to judge against competition like that, but I just felt like the flashes I saw from him last year, he brings something that I feel like Tottenham didn't necessarily have. He's slippery. He's fast. They've got guys who are quick, and they've got great players, obviously, but he's like a different kind of athlete that they don't have on that team.
Right. So take him out of the equation in terms of signings. Nothing was done in the summer. Andrew, I often just look at the bench and I look at that starting 11 and I like it. But say they're in a tight spot in a game and they need to look to the bench to change something, to bring someone on that's got an X factor or someone that might steal a goal. Look at the bench. Davinson Sanchez, Harry Winks. Vorm is obviously a goalkeeper. Fernando Llorente, Serge Aurier, Ben Davis, Luke Amos.
Well,
you talked about depth there. There's nothing off that bench.
Well, hang on. That, and I'll argue against myself for a moment. There's a slight reason for that. Eric Lamela was hurt, not with a serious injury. He'll be back within the next couple weeks. And Heung-min Son is playing in the Asian Games. I mean, that's who you're describing. And he may go back into the starting 11 and move Lucas back to the bench. So they do. I do believe that they have that.
Even if Lamela was on the bench, I'm not a huge Lamela guy. So you've added Lucas Moura into that kind of category as someone who can come off and do something good. Okay, fine. It's still only one player
in my view.
And I still think it's not enough. And if he had his way, Pochettino would definitely have brought in another creative midfielder, possibly a striker. Certainly an attacking player. I'm convinced of that.
I think you're right. And that's ultimately why I'm not going to jump. And then last conclusion here, JJ, Arsenal are still not top four quality.
I'm going to jump with this for a couple of reasons. First of all, if you look at the starts that other teams have had to the season, if you look at their respective opponents, look at Liverpool, Manchester City, look at Chelsea, look at Spurs, look at how they've started the season. First of all, that creates competition that makes you think it's going to be tough for Arsenal or that they're in a real battle to be in the top four. And then you look at the team. Now, I'm convinced that that midfield, when they add in Torreira into that side, can really make a difference. And I believe they need to start Lacazette. I'm convinced of that too. Mm-hmm. But Andrew, look at the back four that played against West Ham. Now, I didn't see this game, so I'm going on match reports and what fans have told me. And what some of my friends have told me. And that Arsenal were far from perfect in this game, but it was obviously very important that they got off to the win. Look at that back four. Bellerin, Mustafi, Socrates, Monreal. I'm not convinced by that back four, Andrew. I'm not convinced by the goalkeeper. And I think that I really like what Emery is trying to do with the team. I think he needs to introduce Torreira. I think he needs, as a starter, very soon. I think he needs to start Lacazette, and he needs to figure out the conundrum with Mkhitaryan and Ozil. But there's so much figuring out to be done with this team that I have the sense that they are not quite top four, and so I'm going to jump to that conclusion.
I will jump with you for many of the reasons that you just mentioned, certainly. And then one other one that I'm not at the point yet where I'm ready to start really worrying. But Aubameyang's gotten off to an oddly slow start this season for a guy who wasn't playing in the World Cup this past summer. I don't know what the deal is with that. If it's only three games, guys go three games all the time without scoring. It's not a big deal. But you know, I mean, the game against Chelsea, he was like really bad. He was like an impediment to them winning rather than just kind of being invisible. So I don't know. That's if their back line is going to struggle throughout the course of the season, which we believe is a distinct possibility, then they're going to have to outscore teams. And when you look at them right now, I mean, do you see a side that's ready to go and do that? I don't know. I'm hesitant to say that I am. And look, part of this question is also, it's not just about them. It's also, if they're top four quality, that means that they would have had to be in a position to get ready to jump those teams ahead of them. They're not better than Manchester City. They're not better than Liverpool. I don't believe they're better than Spurs. Are they better than Manchester United or Chelsea? I would say no. Yeah. So I don't think. I think we're going to hold hands like Thelma and Louise, and we're going to jump.
By the way, we do this every year. It gives me such an amount of trepidation doing this because, like, I honestly just don't know after three games how you can be so brazen as to say these things. But I feel pretty okay with this one on Arsenal.
Yeah, I'm with you. The one I feel worse, the Spurs one is one that I really went back and forth on. So, you know, I hope everyone just kind of like forgets that part and we can move on with our lives. By the way, before we take a quick break here and then we'll have John Strong on the other side, I wanted to tell you something. I meant to tell you this before. My trip, I was away last week down the Jersey Shore in Avalon, New Jersey. It was beautiful. Such a great time, great week with the family and Jack. But one day we took him to this place called Storybook Land. It's like a little amusement park for kids, and it's awesome, perfect for kids his age, and different rides that pertain to different, like Mother Goose or whatever, stuff like that. It was fun. But you know how I know soccer has arrived in this country? I saw something. I witnessed something and it warmed my heart. And I was like, God, I wish JJ was here right now. We were at like this food court area at this little Storybook Land. And I saw a kid sitting at a picnic table. Probably, if I had to ballpark it, I'd say he's probably about 12 years old. And he's sitting there with his family, but he's not paying attention to any of them. He's in his own world. You know why?
Boy.
He's sitting there repeatedly poking himself in the eye as he tries to do the Dele Alli celebration challenge.
Oh, good Lord.
And I was like,
really?
That's beautiful. He's not talking to anyone. He's lost in his own world because he's obsessed with it because he loves the sport and he's in. He's the future. I wanted to go hug him, but I thought, don't do that. Don't do that.
You definitely shouldn't do that.
I thought it was just, I couldn't wait to tell you, but sadly you're deeply unenthused. So I guess we move on.
Well, can I just say one thing? And it was one of those moments where I wished you were there so we could have debated this. I was flying on Aer Lingus into Dublin and they had their movies, which were, they weren't bad, but they had their classics section and they had Fever Pitch, which is obviously the story of the Arsenal fan who it's through the lens of the 1989, that amazing game, that amazing season where Arsenal won on the last day against Liverpool. And right beside it, in the classics section, Andrew, goal three.
Oh, no.
Taking on the world.
Oh, no. That one?
As a classic.
Now, look, you know how much I love the first goal, but goal two is kind of an abomination. Goal three is simply a horror show. I mean, it's like my bar mitzvah video is a better quality than that was with their blue screens that were supposed to simulate real soccer action. I mean, that's bad.
So I tweeted at Aer Lingus. I said, hey, Aer Lingus, there is no way that goal three is a classic film. And Aer Lingus tweeted me back. They said, in your opinion.
Good for them. Good for them. You know what? They're owning it. And I respect that. But I was going to say, do you think they make that decision? Do you think the pilot, like he gets onto the plane and does his routine check of everything in the cockpit and then checks, okay, what classics, goal three, yep, no, check.
But let's be honest. Even though Colin Firth is in it, And it's a very, you know, it's a famous book that was adapted to a film with Jimmy Fallon for the US. But like, Fever Pitch isn't a classic either.
No, no, it's not. The book is really well known. I wouldn't say that the movie rises to that level.
No, and actually, I watched it. I watched the opening hour of Fever Pitch because I couldn't watch the final bit again where Michael Thomas scores to deny Liverpool the title. I just couldn't do it again. But Colin Firth is actually not bad in it. I thought I'd hate him, but I didn't.
Why would you hate him?
I'm not a Firth guy.
Why? Where's this coming from?
I think because so many women find him attractive that I resent him.
Oh, my God. Get over yourself. He's great in The King's Speech. He's great in one of my favorites, Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. He's great in Love, Actually. He's tremendous. No. I reject it. I simply reject it. Hey, it was nice talking with you. I'm going to let you go now. We're going to take a quick break, and then I'm going to talk to John Strong. I can't wait to see you next week. We're going to do Help of Fans. It's going to be great.
It's going to be fantastic.
I'll see you then.
See you, man.
Stay right there. John Strong next. Back on Caught Offside now, and man, this is so fun. One of our favorite guys to talk to. He obviously spent the summer in Russia. We were all watching him and Stuart Holden on Fox's coverage of the World Cup. He's now back in the United States calling MLS games. Really, we've had this guy on several times before, and we always love catching up with him. It is John Strong back on the show right now. John, what is up, man? How are you?
Andrew, I'm good. It's sort of a strange, this aftermath of the World Cup and gearing up for the stretch run of MLS and kind of be a halfway decent husband and father the whole time and all that. And I'm much more exhausted now than I was at any point during the World Cup. So I guess I'm being a good dad.
Kids will do that. I could see that. Let's see. I want to get to some of the World Cup stuff, obviously, because I'm so curious about what that entire experience was like. But this was a pretty massive weekend that we're coming off of in MLS. Of course, rivalry weekend. I kind of want to start there. I mean, you were in Portland for Timber Sounders. Massive 3 points on the road for Seattle. Comes on that really unfortunate own goal. I felt bad for you that they're showing clips of the guy down on the field in tears, and then you're like, well, he's really not going to enjoy this moment of the game coming up here. I mean, in that game, I mean, where did this turnaround right now that we're seeing from Seattle, where did this come from?
Well, I don't know that it's as much that they fixed problems that they've had. I think this is the real version of the Sounders we're seeing now. Not necessarily that they would have won every game or that they would have been leading the supporter shield, but this is, I think, the real version. I think the first half of the season for Seattle, you had some key injuries. You had a couple situations. Nicholas Ladero, and we didn't really get to him in our broadcast Sunday night, but he was pretty honest, and some of his teammates are pretty honest. He was focused on the World Cup. And when he had a little bit of a toe injury, he was probably more conservative about it than he would have been otherwise. And I think him coming back, and the quote from Christian Roldan was, there was a sadness to Ladero missing the World Cup that lit a spark inside of him. And so he's been his real self. Gustav Svensson, similarly, you know, fully focused now on Seattle. The midseason pickup of Rui Diaz was big because they missed something big without Jordan Morris. Not that he's the best striker in the league, but his mobility, his ability to get in behind, all those things that he does that they didn't have, that they now have in Rui Diaz and a quality player. And I think some of it also for Seattle, listen, you have the emotional hangover of their CCL going out in the quarterfinal to Chivas. I think it's hard as well when you've been to the last two MLS Cups to really be firing at all cylinders in March and April. So there's going to be a natural part of that. So I think, as I say, I think this is more the real Sounders now, and the first half of the season was more the aberration. The question is, can they continue to build momentum, make sure they're in the playoffs, because nothing is secured yet. And listen, this would be a heck of a thing if they can rattle off a third straight appearance at MLS Cup. They've already cemented themselves as, you know, along with the LA Galaxy, I think the best MLS team from a trophy winning standpoint since they joined the league. And this would be another really significant statement for how big time this club has become for them to make another run towards the trophy.
Yeah, absolutely. When you came back from Russia, I don't know exactly how many goals it must have been. Joseph Martinez, he was probably sitting on something like 20 goals at that point. Did you look at the calendar when you saw how many goals he had? How long have I been gone? What month is this? I mean, is there a more must-see player in the league right now than him? I know for a while it was, you know, Javinko, but this guy is must-see TV, it feels like, every time Atlanta are on.
It's absolutely incredible. And you remember, he did the same thing last year. He just didn't do it as often because he had the big injury in the spring, and then he got a little bit banged up, and they try to protect him in the fall. It's incredible. I love just watching. And for a player that is in the prime of his career at 25, is not someone that anyone had heard of. I mean, Javinko, you know, you have to be a little bit of a harder core fan because he wasn't a regular at Juventus, but he still was a Juventus player. He'd played for Italy. He was a known quantity. No one knows who Joseph Martinez is, really. And anyone who says they did is either a super hipster or is lying. And so what he's done is quite remarkable. Yeah, I would see, you know, regular emails from the league sort of PR office and their, you know, weekly stats and notes. And it's like, he's the fastest to 10 goals. He's the fastest to 20 goals and these things. And now, you know, part of our focus, honestly, is I've been doing some notes in preparation because our game Sunday is Atlanta at DC United. Is, okay, he's got this regular season record done and dusted, and now you're like, how far can this thing go? Mm-hmm. You know, and I've been looking up, okay, he's got 6 penalties, so 22 non-penalty goals. What's the record for non-penalty goals? What's the record when you include, I mean, he might eclipse the record. I think Roy Lassiter had 33 goals, including the playoffs. He might pass that in the regular season. You know, you're trying to find these degrees of difficulty for what he's been able to accomplish. And the after effect it's had on even someone like Julian Gressel now, 10 assists this season, 9 of them to Martinez. He actually is one back of Sasha Kljestan for the most assists ever by a second-year player in MLS, specifically like someone who came in the league as a rookie. So it's always hard to sort of define those things. But the idea being that someone like Julian Gressel has put up some incredible numbers because of what Martinez has done. And I think it's a fascinating thing right now. And we talked about this some during our broadcast in Portland, this idea of, do they sell him? And they don't have to sell him. And he doesn't necessarily, he's not desperate to go back to Europe. He's played in Europe. Arthur Blank doesn't need the money. And Arthur Blank, again, comes from an NFL mentality of, why would I get rid of my best player? And it's sort of this interesting push-pull of, you know, MLS being a part of the global marketplace and players coming to the league and then using it as a springboard to Europe and the things that opens up, which are good. But by the same token, there's also this other sort of surprising argument being made now that maybe it actually shows how big time MLS is becoming if they don't really need to sell him. If they feel that the salary they're paying him satisfies him and he feels like he's at a big time club. So the whole thing is really, really interesting to watch. And, I mean, they couldn't have struck gold in a bigger way with this guy. It's remarkable.
Yeah, and he's also kind of at the center of this sort of philosophical debate with MLS. And I wanted to ask you about that because it's funny. MLS has me confused right now because, you know, guys like Joseph Martinez.
Get in line, Andrew.
I kind of thought we were past, you know, the over-the-hill European star, all about guys like Martinez, these younger, less heralded Central South Americans. But then here comes Wayne Rooney. Here comes Zlatan Ibrahimovic, both of whom so far, I know it's relatively early in their stints, but they've been major success stories at this point. I mean, was there maybe an overreaction from some people in thinking that MLS was ready to move away completely from the aging European player?
I think the way I would phrase it is this, and I'm as conflicted as perhaps you and some other people are. Is it a good thing or not that guys like Wayne Rooney and Zlatan Ibrahimovic are having as much success as they are? Now, it's worth remembering, this time 2 years ago, I guess now, Zlatan was absolutely wrecking the Premier League. And then he comes off of a pretty major knee injury. You know, someone like Wayne Rooney, I think what you're seeing is a renewed sense of something, like getting that joy back that maybe was lost. And a guy that is doing it because he's working hard and he's doing it the right way. He's not just showing up and waltzing through and scoring 10 goals. That he's doing it the right way. But you're absolutely right. It's still a fascinating dichotomy. And I think my argument would be this, and I will give credit in this instance to Taylor Twellman, because he was the first one, I believe at the beginning of the 2016 season, I think it was that, I remember it was him who was the first one that really made a big point of this publicly. We need to get past the idea of everything being good or bad for MLS as a whole. And I understand single entity, and I understand the centralized contracts and all the tentacles that come off of that. But the reality is, and for those of us that actually take the time to get involved and we don't just chirp about it on social media, there is a great divergence in clubs, in ownerships, in general managers, in coaches. You're seeing now, you can define not all of the clubs in MLS, but a lot of them you can define by style of play, style of player, the culture they've created around themselves in the cities that they're in. And so that's part of it that, you know what, if DC United want to go that route and they want to spend big money on Wayne Rooney and they're going to have success, good for them. But it's not necessarily that it's a referendum on what MLS is doing, because there's a bunch of other clubs that want nothing to do with that. So I'm seeing it more as just finding these different paths different clubs want to go on and finding success in different ways. And if DC United is going to roar to life with Wayne Rooney, and if Seattle is going to roar to life with Raul Ruiz Diaz and the way they've collected players, and if Toronto's going to roar to life with the same crew that they've had, they got to a slow start. Those are three very different waves of going about a vaguely similar story, which is sort of the mid-season resurgence that we often see in MLS.
I love it. Just tell everybody, you know what, you do you, and just go with that. I love it.
I think that's the thing, and just judge them on that, and if it's a success for DC, we'll judge you there, and if it's a failure, we'll judge you there. But I've long since gotten past, I think, sort of the hand-wringing about what does this say for MLS? What image does this sort of project? It's like it's really just more about, you know, the individual clubs, and for me, that is a sign of growth in the league, that we are getting to that sort of point.
Yeah, one more on MLS for you before we move on. You mentioned Toronto. I feel like I'm contractually obligated to ask a Toronto FC question, because you know, JJ and I were sitting here in MLS preseason, and while CONCACAF Champions League was going on, and we're having debates with people on Twitter and between ourselves about whether or not this is the greatest MLS team in history. Now fast forward here to late August, and they're like a fringe playoff team, maybe lucky if they get in. I mean, what? How? Like, there's so many reasons, I guess, as to why this could be. I'm curious for why you think they're in the state that they're in right now.
Well, last year, to my mind, is undoubtedly the best season in MLS history, just for the fact that no one had ever done a clean sweep of those trophies, the manner in which they did it, the quality with which they did it, and the fact, and this is something that Greg Vanney was very prideful about, that the bulk of that team last year, as much as we focus on Jovinko and Victor Vasquez was a great addition, and it's a little bit of an aberration because guys like Michael Bradley and Jozy Altidore are megastars. But Greg Vanney was very proud of the fact the bulk of his team was North American. 8 of his 11 regular starters were either American or Canadian. And they took a great pride in succeeding in that way. Whether it's the best team in MLS history, that becomes somewhat subjective. And you've got a couple, you know, there's two eras of the LA Galaxy you can throw in there, et cetera, et cetera. As far as what happened this year, I do think it's a perfect storm of the energy and attention focused on CONCACAF Champions League early in the season, digging themselves the hole. They've had key injuries at key times. And sometimes you just, you know, I've heard the idea winning becomes a habit and losing becomes a habit too. And sometimes that dark cloud just sort of roots itself right on top of you and it's hard to shake it. And I this is sort of similar to the last answer. Would it be a good thing for a Toronto FC, for a Seattle Sounders, big clubs, to miss the playoffs? Would it be a good thing, again, contradicting myself of the sort of broad-based messages for MLS, to basically say, hey, if you dig yourselves a hole early in the season, you're not going to be able to get back out, and trying to increase something that I do think is very important, which is the idea that the entire regular season matters. By the same token, you know, is it also something that we should celebrate in sports, a team being able to turn it around? It's a team that's fun to watch. It's a team that's gone about things the right way. And would it be a remarkable thing for them to roar back to life? I don't really know. But I absolutely am watching it with fascination, yeah, to see if they could actually get there, because they've not yet rattled off the type of string that Seattle or even DC has. It's been sort of in fits and starts, and they've got a game here in Portland this week, and you know, they're running out of time a little bit. And is the question, because we've talked about this in context to Seattle, as compared to 2 years ago, as compared to when the Galaxy were doing this in 2012, the quality around you isn't that much better that, you know, you can go on a run. But by the way, the teams above you have played well as well, and you can't catch them. So I don't know, again, is it good, is it bad, what's going to happen? But it is very interesting to watch how you can go from, and listen, we see it in plenty of the big leagues as well, a team that's absolute king 1 year falls apart the next through a variety of situations. And, you know, particularly as we sort of ask big picture questions about the legacy of Michael Bradley and Jozy Altidore with regards to the national team, the fact that they're going through these struggles with their clubs as well, I think adds to that sort of chip on the shoulder that both guys are playing with.
Yeah, John Strong, kind enough to give us some time here on Caught Offside during what is certainly a busy time. John, I do want to ask you a little bit about your experience this summer in Russia. First of all, does it make you sad in some way that Stuart Holden's brother probably came out of that month more famous than either you or Stuart? Plain
that
Bay,
was,
yeah.
I can't even describe to you how bizarre that whole scenario was, in large part because it's a 10-hour time difference, and so it's like you're catching up on the day's news the following day, and we would wake up and go about our business, and we'd be like, okay, what happened today in Ewan's life? What a bizarre thing, and you know, I've gotten the chance to meet and hang out some with Ewan over the last couple of years, and I think Stu was just sort of bewildered by the whole thing, and that's like one of the ways in which this is going to go down is one of the more unique month and a half, I think, for any of us involved in this whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, how was Russia as a host nation? There was so much talk and concern coming in, and it seemed from afar like we made it through incident-free. What was it like on the ground there?
Yeah, I think that's always the case. We were worried about Brazil 4 years ago because of the anti-government protests the prior year in the Confederations Cup. We were worried about crime in South Africa in 2010. We were worried about, you know, terrorism at the 2012 London Olympics. I mean, every major event, basically in perpetuity, is going to have with it very legitimate concerns. But it's also, I think, there's so many people, including the government, that are so motivated for it to run well, you end up getting everyone's best face. Doesn't mean it's incident-free, and they were absolutely found ourselves in where you could go, okay, this is the infrastructure of this country being pushed further than it's meant to by this influx of millions of people, and even something as simple as a crush of hundreds and hundreds of Colombian fans trying to get back to Moscow, and there's like three check-in desks at the Kazan airport. So those types of situations you find yourself in where you're like, okay, this is definitely the raggedy edge of things. But in general, it was great, and we were lucky enough to experience Russia the prior year in the Confederations Cup, so a lot of us knew what to expect. There were still moments where you're like, wow, how did we get ourselves into this particular moment in time? But it was overall, it was wonderful, and it feels like a million years ago. I actually just last week, I don't know why, but for the first time, I was busy down in my office late at night prepping. I often do a lot of my work for games after the rest of the family's in bed. And I ended up, for whatever random reason, for the first time since the final, more than a month after, watching back some of the final and just some of the moments of the game and some of the pre- and post-game coverage. And it was sort of like an out-of-body experience of like, that was me, I was there, but it feels like forever ago. And so trying to find little mementos. I've got right across from me, as I talked to you, I bought for my son at a toy store a little like a 3D model of Luzhniki Stadium that we put together. Cool. And sort of that exists as a fun memento and things like that. And yeah, you do sort of exist in that thing of you don't want to forget it. You want to keep it fresh in your mind because it was so special. It was so meaningful. And it's something that I had chased for a very long time. But by the same token, it's done. It's over. You got to forget it. And if I'm terrible at my job this fall, doesn't matter what I did in June. You know, it matters what's in front of me. So it's a strange place to be in, and very similar to a lot of these players. And I had a great chat with Gustav Svensson about it actually the other week of that challenge of sort of wanting to, like I say, keep it fresh in your mind, but also being willing to forget it ever happened and focus on what's ahead of you. And luckily for us, what's ahead of us is, I mean, another great stretch run of MLS. We have MLS Cup on Fox this year. We've got a couple of great men's national team games, including the one against Brazil next week, which is going to be a hoot. So in that regard, it's not like there's just sort of this sad hangover that we have so much to look ahead of us with excitement to for the rest of the year.
I'm curious for this. You have, and I don't mean for this to come across like a, you know, brown nosing or kissing up or anything like that. But being honest for a minute, I mean, you've kind of over the last several years emerged as this American voice of soccer here in this country. I mean, yeah, I think that was kind of, at least in my mind, solidified in a certain way, watching you at this World Cup as the lead voice and do the World Cup final. And look, ESPN did an amazing job when it was Martin Tyler and Ian Dark and John Champion. But I do think there is a certain level of importance for the main soccer voice in this country to be an American voice. I mean, how cognizant are you of that, that you've kind of emerged as that guy for this sport here in the U.S.?
It's a balance to that because, you know, I think critically about all the different parts of my business and what I do as an individual and sort of the bigger picture of soccer broadcasting in America. We talk about it a lot ourselves, but it's also, if I talk about it, especially if I talk about myself out loud, that can easily be heard the wrong way. And I've also very deliberately this year pulled away from social media, pulled away from reading any of the, whether good or bad, reading any of those things and just getting in a nice little, I call it my zen place of just focus on what I can control around me and try to be really good. It has definitely been gratifying to have heard the things that people have said, whether it's coworkers of mine, whether it's former coworkers or those I've never actually worked with at other networks, whether it's fans. That type of stuff has been very special. I mean, it's interesting because I ended up having wonderful conversations at the tournament with Andres Cantor and Martin Tyler about the same thing. And not necessarily to repeat out loud what they said to me, but that idea of, you know, the people that ostensibly I'm competing against for legitimacy, they're some of my biggest supporters. And what a wonderful thing that is. And like I said, I think before, it's that balance of taking that as a sense of confidence. As a, you know, when I listen to myself back calling the final, is it the best work I've ever had in my life? Perhaps not, but, and certainly I'm going to continue to improve, and I'm only scratching the surface of how well I can do this, hopefully. But I also don't sound like someone that doesn't belong there. I don't sound like someone that's sort of impersonating a sports announcer. I feel like, you know, I earned that, and we did the best we could have done in there. And it is fun to now, you know, consider what's in front of us. And listen, we're back into, you know, MLS as compared to Premier League, as compared to the national team and all those other things sort of come in. Whereas at the World Cup, we had the stage to ourselves for a month. But it is definitely something I do take seriously and I am mindful of. But I'm also not naive to the fact that, A, like I said, I can't just think, well, I called a World Cup, I've made it, and get away from the good habits that got me here. But also the awareness that, you know, if I just call one World Cup and if that's it and I end up fading into obscurity by the time Qatar rolls around, was it really worth it? I want to be in this role for multiple World Cups. I want to be in this role for multiple decades if I can help it, because I have the advantage of being pretty young. And so knowing that I have a whole army of young kids that are in colleges or are in their young 20s that want to be broadcasters, want to be soccer broadcasters. They're all gunning for my job now. And so how can I stay out in front of them and how can I continue to improve and I could continue the good habits that have gotten me here while also just, you know, taking as a wonderful gift every single time I get to do this, because you also have to be aware it is show business. And there have been plenty of other announcers who have called a World Cup on English language U.S. television, and that sort of for one reason or another, by the time of the next World Cup, it was someone else. So I also can't get too carried away with, you know, what sort of spot I find myself in now, if that all makes sense.
Well, it certainly does. And trust me, in talking with friends who love this sport, I would say that your trajectory in the mind of the soccer public is certainly upward. You guys were tremendous.
I'm very happy to hear that.
Oh, yeah. It's unanimous, man. I mean, honestly, from people that I talk with. Before I let you go, I did want to ask you something briefly about U.S. soccer, and not necessarily the stock question about was the experience in Russia shaded negatively by them not being there, but just, you know, here we are now, and I think the dust really has settled at this point from what happened in Trinidad and Tobago that night. Are we in good shape? Are we still way behind? I mean, can you get a sense at this point of where U.S. soccer is in relation to where it needs to be for what just happened to never happen again? I feel like that's such a big question that we could probably do like an entire show on it, and we certainly have. But, I mean, what's the sense you get now about where this team is at?
Yeah, I mean, people have been having that conversation pretty much nonstop since October, and we still haven't found the answers. So in one part, you know, I don't know. I certainly hope so, because – you know, we got to a point where we were in Russia. There were a couple moments where we're like, man, what a hoot this would have been with the U.S. But there were other moments where we realized that we got to call games we wouldn't have been able to had we been focused on the U.S. That's just the reality. And I think it was also, I think there were unintended consequences of a good kind to the U.S. not being there. But that's not germane to your question. As far as what sort of shape are we in, I think from a player standpoint, I think we're in a pretty good shape. I'm really intrigued by this young core of players that we've seen emerge in this year. I very much like the direction Dave Sarakin, in an entirely no-win scenario, the direction he's taken on the types of players he's brought in. We'll see what the roster looks like, because you're absolutely right. This is a very different time now, even than May. This is a sort of, okay, the World Cup is over. Now you really are beginning the next cycle. And what do you do with the Michael Bradleys and the Jozy Altidores and some of those players, the Brad Guzans? You know, who is the next coach going to be? Have we really figured this stuff out? You know, Ernie Stewart in as the technical director, everyone's saying the right things, but there's also plenty of very legitimate concerns about, you know, articles recently about sort of a hiring freeze going on with the youth national teams. Can still very legitimate questions and concerns and complaints about some of these bigger picture issues of coaching education. Are we casting a wide enough net? All those types of things. But I think from a micro standpoint, when I look at Christian Pulisic, obviously, Weston McKennie, Tyler Adams, some of the young defenders coming through, Carter Vickers and Matt Miazga, I mean, there's some good players filtering through. And you're seeing more and more that are getting opportunities in Europe. I still would deeply, deeply love to see more of these homegrown players get on the field sooner in MLS. And again, that's a whole other larger conversation. But I think from a player standpoint, we're in a pretty good spot, absolutely. But very still very legitimate questions that do not and aren't anywhere close to being answered. Bigger picture, who's the coach going to be, the technical direction, some of those things which remain to be seen. You know, can we guarantee ourselves to never be in that spot again? Yes and no. You know, the World Cup is expanding and those types of things. And maybe the complacency, which in retrospect absolutely existed at this time last year, going into those September games, which ended up really, the loss to Costa Rica, I think, is just as damaging as the Trinidad game for the U.S. not getting there. So are you past that because the memory is going to be fresh for a while? Yeah, probably. And do you feel like you're in a good direction with the players you have coming through? Absolutely. But can any of us sit here and say, okay, we're all good, everything's figured out? I think it would be very naive to do so.
Yep, certainly would. Hey, love catching up with you always. You guys, seriously, were a joy to watch in Russia. You've been a joy since you've got back here calling MLS games on Fox and Fox Sports 1. As always, John Strong, thanks so much for joining us here on Caught Offside. Thanks, man.
Andrew, thank you so much. I very much appreciate your kind words and always enjoy these chats.
Oh, awesome stuff, as always, from John Strong, one of our favorite guys to catch up with. I'm sure we'll do it again as MLS continues. We head into the playoffs. U.S. soccer getting ready to come back with some friendlies. Always something to discuss with John, so we'll have to talk with him again. What to watch for coming up in mere moments, but before that, yes! Oh, a new sponsor that I'm so excited to talk about, NetSuite. That's right. Every company battles challenges as they grow, updating manual processes, replacing inefficient systems, getting a handle on cash flow. As you scale, you'll need software that can handle that growth. This isn't one-size-fits-all software with industry-specific support for a broad range of businesses. NetSuite works the way your business works. That's right. We are introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform. With NetSuite, you can save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing sales, finance, and accounting, orders, and HR instantly right from your desk or even your phone. Right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights to overcome the obstacles that are holding you back for free. Don't miss out on unleashing your business's full potential with this free guide. It's called Crushing the Five Barriers to Growth. You'll learn how to acquire new customers, increase profits, and finally get real visibility into your cash flow. This is like perfect and ideal for people in the burgeoning world of podcasting, even. Here's how you do it. Get NetSuite's guide, Crushing the Five Barriers to Growth, when you go to netsuite.com/offside right now. Download their free Crushing the Five Barriers to Growth guide today at netsuite.com/offside. It's super easy. The product is awesome. netsuite.com/offside. Check it out. You will not regret it. I promise you that. Let's see. It is what to watch for time. We begin with MLS because it is a midweek week in MLS. By the way, I don't have them on here, but I did want to take this time to mention New York Red Bulls are playing 5 games in a 15-day stretch. Like this, the MLS schedule is a thrill a minute, and it is once again going to be a thrill. Midweek, Wednesday night, 8 o'clock p.m., DC United and the suddenly surging Philadelphia Union. Here come the Union. They've won 4 straight, including their Open Cup semifinal. Their triumph in that one 3-0 over Chicago as they prepare for the final coming up in a few weeks or so against the Dynamo. It's not just, though, that they've won those four. It's who they've done it against. 2 against New England, with whom they're in direct competition right now for a playoff spot, and the other one against NYCFC, who until that match felt like they were in real competition for possible shot at the Supporters' Shield. They still may be NYCFC, but it's sort of hard to envision that with the way Atlanta United FC are going right now. But nevertheless, the Philadelphia Union beating good teams, important games. And here's the other thing. I guess it pays to play until the end. Here's what happened to the Union if you didn't see it this past weekend. Corey Burke scored the winner for Philly over the weekend. It was a breakaway goal that was deemed offside basically the moment that he touched the ball. He kept going, though. He scored and then kind of foolishly runs to the sideline, ripped his shirt off in celebration, despite basically all 21 other people on the field thinking that this was not a goal and that he was now making a fool of himself. But they all, of course, failed to take into account VAR. VAR looked at it, saw that it was actually onside, and the goal stood, and the Union won 1-0. In that game. Now they get DC United coming up Wednesday at 8. Wednesday at 10:30, the Portland Timbers and Toronto FC. This is fascinating, this match. Two teams really in crucial places right now. Portland, their torrid run, they were unbeaten for 3 months straight, and now they're outside of the playoff picture. How can that happen? Have you ever heard of something like that? Unbeaten for 3 months, but still at this point in late August, if it ended today, Portland would not be in the postseason. They have cooled off significantly. They've lost 4 straight, now on the outside looking in. They do, however, have 3 games at hand over 6th place LA Galaxy and 4th place Real Salt Lake. So obviously things can change once things begin to even themselves out. The loss that Portland is coming off of, the game that John Strong, we were talking about, that he was on the call with Stuart Holden, what a crushing loss. I mean, an awkward bounce off of Julio Cascante for the own goal. The shots were 22-6 in Portland's favor, but they could not finish chances, and it came back to bite them on that brutal own goal. Toronto, meanwhile, coming off a massive win against Montreal, breathing some life, perhaps, back into their playoff hopes. The issue for Toronto right now, I think it's lazy to say this, but just fending off injuries. You know, a lot of teams can say that, but just the magnitude, the importance of the injuries that they've had to deal with over the course of the season. Name a key player. At some point, a key player for them has been dealing with injuries. Giovinco limped off. Vasquez is dealing with an injury. So we'll see if they're able to contend with that for throughout the remainder of the season and get themselves into the playoffs. Now, Giovinco talked about this. He believes conditions on the pitch are behind this reason. He was asked if he, because he hurt himself. You could see when he scored his second goal because Toronto jumped out to that 3-0 lead in the first 29 minutes. And when Javinko scored his second, it looked like he was kind of limping and he was kind of gingerly moving around afterwards. He was asked if he hurt himself leading up to the second goal. He said, yeah, because we continue to put sand on the grass and the Argos play there, Toronto Argonauts, the CFL team. TFC2 plays there. Everybody plays on this field, and then every game we lose a player to an injury. This is not possible. You're hearing this more and more. I feel like we're starting to reach a breaking point with playing surfaces in this league. If key players are going to keep on missing important matches and extended time because of conditions of the playing surface, the league's going to have to step in and do something. This is not a new thing necessarily, but whether it's artificial turf, whether it's situations like what Toronto FC are dealing with, putting sand on this grass field because of football teams that are playing there and minor league soccer, it's, I don't know, man. As more and more players continue to gripe about this, you wonder if it could become a collectively bargained issue. Europa League qualifying, that continues Thursday, 2:45. Oh, boy. Oh, where's Sean Dyche when you need him? Sean, where are you? Burnley and Olympiacos, with Olympiacos taking a 3-1 lead in the first leg as they head back to the Turf Moor. They are in danger of crashing out, those fighting Burnleys. I wonder right now how much their head is turned with this Europa League qualifying campaign. 0 wins, 2 losses, and 1 draw to start the domestic season for Burnley. And here's the thing. It's not just the bad start, the 0 wins through 3 matches, but it's just been so uncharacteristic. 7 goals they've allowed so far in 3 games. Only Huddersfield and West Ham have conceded more. It's just so not like them. They've got United coming up at the weekend in kind of a desperation game for both teams. I still say Burnley really have to go for it in the Europa League, obviously, because this is kind of once-in-a-lifetime territory that we're bordering on right now. But I would say this, if they do go out, it would be crushing, it would be sad, because I'm sure the fans and the players were so geeked up for this to happen, but it's not all bad. We kind of lose perspective on Burnley, but going into last season, a lot of people thought they were relegation candidates. They had this dream year, they finished seventh, but I don't know that we know just yet exactly what they are. So as much fun as a Europa League campaign would be, who knows? Maybe they fall back into being relegation candidates if they're worrying about contending in multiple competitions and if they just don't have the squad depth for it. So, again, I'll be rooting for them. But if they lose, I would say there is a silver lining there. Thursday also, 3 o'clock p.m., Celtic and FK Saduva, 1-1. Heading back to Celtic Park for the second leg. Ooh, can you imagine? Celtic, after they crashed out of Champions League qualification, if they crash out of Europa League qualification as well, there's got to be European football for Celtic, right? EPL, here we go, at the weekend, Saturday, 7:30 a.m., Leicester City and Liverpool. Sounds like Jamie Vardy is stepping away from international football. He didn't outright retire, but he still left the door open if Gareth Southgate needed him. If injuries became a concern, something like that, he would leave the door open. But he said he's done, barring something like that. He's 31. He's been capped 26 times. Really had an amazing career span in 3 years where he went from playing non-league at Fleetwood to starting for his country. It was really an amazing rise for him. So if that is the end of Jamie Vardy's international career, congrats to him, because there was certainly a period of time where that probably looked like a far-fetched dream. Leicester off to a good start this season, 2 wins and a loss, that loss on opening day at Old Trafford, where they actually played fairly well, I thought, in that game. Remember, they come into the season with no Riyad Mahrez. Vardy given a straight red in the second game, so he's essentially missed a game and a half. I give Leicester credit. That's not an easy run-in that they've had to start the season. New faces have really been left with no choice but to step up and help carry this team. James Maddison, obviously Harry Maguire has continued his good form from this past summer. Damari Gray scoring an important goal over the weekend. So props to Leicester under not the easiest of circumstances, but getting off to a good start this year. Saturday, 12:30, Manchester City and Newcastle. Oh, the highs and lows of this game can really be a brutal ride. And who knows that better right now than DeAndre Yedlin? And myself, as an American fan, and I'm sure lots of American fans watching that game, how pumped were you? Weren't you just loving it when you saw the way he not that I condone this, and he kind of got away with a foul, but, showing some physical strength, bullies Olivier Giroud, elbow. Again, probably should have been called, but nevertheless, it wasn't. Takes it on first touch, and then plays in a beautiful cross to Joselu, who scores the equalizer against Chelsea. Huge moment for Yedlin, huge moment for Newcastle, and then what happens? The next moment, he's scoring the own goal on Marcus Alonso's shot that gives Chelsea the win. The only consolation, I guess, in looking at that, that I would give Yedlin is, had he not deflected it into his net, I still believe that Chelsea were going to score there, because it looked like Ross Barkley was just kind of in a poacher's position at the far post, where if that ball gets by Yedlin, I think Barkley taps in. But nevertheless, it didn't go that way. Yedlin did score the own goal just minutes after setting up that beautiful goal for Joselu. Football is, oh, it is a cruel, cruel beast. And then Sunday, 11 o'clock a.m., Watford, who's been the unquestioned surprise of the season so far, they will host Tottenham at Vicarage Road. Three wins in three matches for Watford, a team that lost Richarlison right before the beginning of the year. Roberto Pereira has been a revelation. Three goals so far this season for them, although the one goal that he scored this past weekend, I don't believe that that was on purpose. Looked like kind of one of those crosses that, that's going in the back of the net. So Watford and Spurs Sunday at 11. Couple other things that I did want to mention. Sunday at noon, the Old Firm Derby, Celtic and Rangers. That's at 7 a.m. Eastern time. And Thursday, it is your Champions League group stage draw. Oh. Yes. Yeah. The best teams, the best teams, the better teams. Go, for new people to this podcast, go look up, go Google the lyrics to the Champions League anthem. I think suddenly you may not find it quite as dramatic as you believed. But that is Thursday, I believe, at noon Eastern time. So there you go. Hey, that is the show. Two podcasts out this week. Check out our other one where we I go through the biggest games from over the past weekend, Jose Mourinho, his status, all that good stuff. Plus, JJ checks in with the mailbag. We got a big red card man of the match. And I divulge why I was just absolutely furious, beyond furious, with JJ on Monday afternoon at roughly 4:45 p.m. Hey, this was fun. Boy, it's weird saying goodbye to JJ without him here, but still, I guess we got to do it. To you, I say...
Take it later, fun boy.
See you later, everybody.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.